and Asians. And I've been to Asia many times to speak, and what I notice is the Asian culture is very much, you know, they really kind of stick to their own. You got the Japanese, you got the Koreans, you got the Vietnamese, you got the Chinese, and they really like to be amongst their own. They don't like to mix. This church is breaking that mold. And they have people from all these different Asian backgrounds that get together. And what I really appreciate it, they're focusing on reaching beyond the Asian community. So that was really a wonderful time and a lot of good Q&A with those folks. And if you're interested, I do have videos of all the messages I gave there, including a Q&A posted on my Facebook page. So you can go there and watch that. And they're really building Q&A into their churches. And it's something I've said here before, is that every church I've been to where they have a Q&A session after the sermon is a church that's growing by adult converts. And so it's one of the missions I have as I travel around and visit churches, is encouraging them to build open mic Q&A into their teaching times. So then this past week, I made a quick trip up to the University of Nevada in Reno. And they used to call Reno the biggest little city. I think they need to change the name because there's about 500,000 people there now. It's no longer a little city. And the university is growing very rapidly, mainly because a lot of Californians have discovered they can enroll there and actually spend less money than if they stay in the California system. So they got a lot of California students there. But it's the first time they've ever had a campus-wide outreach, and we're actually planning to do an even bigger event in the next few months. And question for all of you. How many have ever heard of the square kilometer array? Anybody? Okay, we got two people have heard of it. A square kilometer array, and this is what it's an artist's conception of what they hope to build. It's an array of radio telescopes that will be half in Australia and half in South Africa. And they found two places where they got big deserts where nobody lives, and therefore there's very little radio interference, and they've actually set aside boundaries around these areas, or they're going to ban, radio, ground radio communications. So it'll be a radio quiet era. So these are two parts of the world that they're going to enforce a radio quiet policy, and that's because they're going to be building literally thousands of these small telescopes, and the combined collecting area will be 1 square kilometer. And to put that in perspective, that's more than 50 times the collecting area of any existing telescope in the world today. So, and what I want to share with you today, the very first scientific discovery from a piece of the square kilometer array. It's not finished yet, but just a few weeks ago, they opened up for operation a part of it, and it's called the Meerkat, M-E-E-R-K-A-T, and the K-A-T stands for the Kilometer Array Telescope. And so there's 64 of these. And to give you an idea of the size, it's about 40 feet from top to bottom and 30 feet wide. And so there's 64 of these antenna already operating in South Africa. And just this week, they published the first result from this array. And basically, this is a fundraising thing where they're saying, look, what we've been able to do with 64. Give us some money and we'll build 1,000 of these. And so the idea is there'd be about 500 in South Africa, looking like this, and 500 in Australia. But it's more ambitious than that. In addition to these 1,000 40 by 30 foot telescopes, radio telescopes, they're going to be putting in an equally comprehensive low frequency array. So this is like a dipole array. And the goal is to be able to observe continuously from about 50 hertz all the way up to 14 gigahertz. You may not be familiar, that's a wavelength measure, but typically a radio telescope will look at a very narrow band, like say 3 gigahertz or 10 gigahertz or 100 kilohertz. This is an instrument designed to take in data from literally across that entire radio spectrum. So the goal is that they'd be observing the entirety of the radio spectrum continuously through a combination of dipole arrays that, again, will have a collecting area of 1 square kilometer combined with an array of telescopes that will also cover 1 square kilometer. So these will do the high-frequency part of the radio spectrum, and this will take in the low-frequency part of the radio spectrum. And what makes this especially ambitious, the data that's going to come through this instrument is equivalent to the entire database of the internet. So think of all the data that's on the internet. This thing generates that much data. And so one of the challenges in trying to complete this project is having a computer system that can process all this data and process it continuously. But I don't know of any instrument that's generating more excitement in the astronomical community than this particular instrument, and that's because it literally is a factor of 50 greater sensitivity than any other thing that exists. And once this thing is completed, and the completion date is like 2023, 2024, depending, they don't have all the funding yet. And interestingly, it's being funded by 11 nations, and the United States is not one of them. They basically said, no, we need to spend our money on space telescopes. And so 11 other nations have gotten together to say, well, we need something of high sensitivity, and you can't do that in space. It's got to be done on the ground. So, but, yes.
I'd like to know, what are they really focusing on finding?
Well, probably the thing that's generating the most excitement, this will have the sensitivity to be able to determine what's behind dark matter. One of the holy grails of astronomy is to try to discover the particles or the particle decay signature of what makes up about 23% of the entirety of the universe. I mean, we can see the gravity being exerted by dark matter, but actually finding exactly where that dark matter is located. I mean, the astronomers would love to know, okay, where exactly is the distribution of this dark matter around different kinds of galaxies? And one of the things that they've already determined is that it looks like the distribution of dark matter for our galaxy is different than that of any other known galaxy. And probably is one reason explains why we have a large galaxy with such highly symmetrical spiral arms, with very little feathers or spurs, where there's decent spacing between the spiral arms. It's one of the critical features that makes advanced life possible here on Earth. And a lot of astronomers are suggesting that it's because of the unique distribution of dark matter. I mean, one thing we do know, for example, is that compared to a galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy is about the same total mass as our galaxy, but our galaxy is about 90% dark matter, where in the case of the Andromeda galaxy, it looks like it's more like 50% dark matter. And so that may explain why we see disturbances in the Andromeda galaxy that we don't see in our galaxy. But it's this instrument that's really going to be able to nail all that down. Right now, as you read the scientific literature, these are kind of suggestions and hints of what's going on. But this square kilometer array, astronomers are convinced this is really going to solve a lot of the missing problems. They're also are going to be using it to determine the nature of dark energy. But what it is going to do immediately is produce extremely detailed radio maps of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And that's really the first discovery that got published. And again, we're talking only 64 of these telescopes. So that's what exists right now, and it only exists in South Africa. The Australian part has not yet been combined. And you say, well, why are they putting it on Australia and South Africa? Well, they're going to be getting all this collecting area, but they also want high resolution. And so at radio astronomy wavelengths, you can actually get both the amplitude information of the radio and you can get the phase information. At optical wavelengths, you only get the amplitude. But because we get the phase, which means you actually know the position of the individual waves. And if you know the position of the individual waves, that means that you can link together telescopes that are thousands of miles apart and get the resolution of a telescope that would be the equivalent of 1,000 miles apart. So this will have a baseline of a little more than, I think it's going to be like 6,000 miles or 5,500 miles. So not only are they going to have very high collecting area, they're going to have extremely high resolution. Question?
What's the name of it? Is it this one or the other one?
Okay. The master thing is called the square kilometer array, because both the low frequency and the high frequency are going to have a collecting area of 1 square kilometer. But the piece that's operational now, which is just kind of a small subset of the square kilometer array, it's called the Meerkat, M-E-E-R-K-A-T. And of course, if you've been to Africa, they got these little rodents running all over the place that are called meerkats. And the way it works in radio astronomy, you never begin a project like this until you come up with some kind of cute acronym. So the Meerkat actually stands for a lot of details, but yeah, we always have to come up with an acronym before we start a project. However, what just got released this week is that they were able to use the Meerkat array to come up with the most detailed map of the center of our galaxy. And it led to some discoveries that have profound philosophical significance. I read the paper. The researchers really did not comment on the philosophical implications of what they discovered. That's fairly typical of research scientists. They just want to tell you about all the cool results that they came up with and not what it all means. But I got a blog coming out in a few weeks from now that actually gets into not only what they discovered, but what it all means philosophically. So I'm going to give you kind of a brief review of that. This shows you an infrared map or image of the center of our galaxy. That little red spot there is where you got a supermassive black hole, and that massive black hole is sucking in material into it, and outside the event horizon, you get matter being converted to energy with more than 10% efficiency. So that explains why you got such a bright spot there. Incidentally, that's typical of virtually every galaxy, that it has a giant black hole at the core, and that's why you see a bright spot in the nucleus of all galaxies. I mentioned a few weeks before that astronomers have now made precision measurements on the mass of our supermassive black hole. It comes in at about 3.96 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. That sounds like a lot, but of all large spiral galaxies, we have by far the smallest supermassive black hole. To give you an idea, we have the Andromeda Galaxy, 2.5 million light years away, and its supermassive black hole is about 40 to 50 times bigger than the supermassive black hole that we have in our galaxy. Same size galaxy, and the Andromeda Galaxy has a typical supermassive black hole. Our galaxy has got the smallest supermassive black hole relative to the mass of the galaxy. So this is the best and most detailed image we have of the center of our galaxy at infrared wavelengths. This is the most detailed map we have at X-ray and ultraviolet and a gamma ray. This is actually a composite of images from 3 space telescopes. And to give you a sense of location, that really bright spot you see off the right, that's where the supermassive black hole is. But what you notice is that X-ray, and especially X-ray wavelengths, you see all those filaments there? You can't see those at optical wavelengths. They do show up at X-ray and gamma ray wavelengths. And you also see a couple little bubbles just a little bit to the left and below the supermassive black hole. That all is shown at X-ray and gamma ray wavelengths. And this is an old radio map of the center of our galaxy. And this was taken a few years back with the very large array in New Mexico. That's an array of 27 radio telescopes, where each radio telescope is about 85 feet across. And this ranks as the most detailed map to date of the center of our galaxy at radio wavelengths. And what caught people's attention is that you see little spikes all over the place. By the way, that bright spot, that's where the supermassive black hole is. But what you see is particularly to the right and above of that supermassive black hole, you see these sprites, these little, and so those are radio jets. And people have been wondering what's behind it. And they've been speculating that perhaps there was an outburst from the supermassive black hole about 6 to 7 million years ago. And as they've looked at these sprites, they're actually able to determine what their ages are. And the ages range from 1 million years ago to about 7 million years ago. But most of them are coming in, the biggest and brightest ones are coming in at 6 to 7 million years ago. So this has been well known for about the past 4 years. But what has been a mystery is exactly what is responsible for these radio spikes. And this is where MEERKAT comes in, because MEERKAT has produced a far more detailed map, and they have yet to release the full high-resolution map. That's why I'm not showing it to you. When it becomes available, I'll try to pop it up here for you. But it's much more detailed than this. And moreover, not only do they have a much more detailed map of the center of the galaxy, they mapped a region far bigger than what you see here. And actually, they're mapping about the they went out to about 2,000 light years from the center of our galaxy. And to give you some idea, we're a little less than 26,000 light years from the center of our galaxy. So they actually mapped quite a large portion of that region. And because they were able to come up with a really big detailed map of that region around that supermassive black hole, they found something no one ever had seen before, which is two big radio lobes coming out from the region of the center of the galaxy. And the total dimensions, it's basically two big lobes or two big bubbles that stretch out from the center of the galaxy, and they're able to measure the extent of it. It's 1,400 light years by about 350 light years. So kind of long, thin lobes or bubbles coming out from the center of the galaxy. They're able to measure the energy output. And the energy output, I'm trying to get this off from memory. I had all this stuff written down, but I left it at home. So I'm just guessing on the figure, but it's roughly equivalent to a few billion years worth of energy output from the sun is packed inside these two lobes. So there's a lot of energy there. And then the paper ends by saying, okay, we think that these two big lobes we discovered are related to these radio sprites. Why? Because they're able to notice that these lobes are getting bigger, and they're able to measure the rate at which they're getting bigger. And the rate they measured indicates that there's not been much deceleration in the growth of the lobe. So by looking at how fast it's getting bigger, you're able to determine that roughly the lobes formed about 6 to 7 million years ago, which is the same time as most of these sprites that you see here. And therefore, they concluded that about 6 to 7 million years ago, that supermassive black hole must have absorbed a big chunk of matter, either a small star or a big molecular cloud got sucked into that supermassive black hole. And as it came close to the event horizon, a lot of that matter got converted into energy and hence have produced these sprites and these two really big lobes. But they also noticed that they have found the remnants of a star cluster that was really close to the supermassive black hole. And this was published a few years back where they were able to find out that this was a cluster of probably 1 to 200 supermassive stars all tightly jammed together. And they would have all gone supernova at roughly the same time. And that too could produce this. Although the researchers said in their paper, there's so much energy here, we actually think it's a combination of the two. Because if you get a cluster that's orbiting around that supermassive black hole, where you got these supergiant stars all going supernova at the same time, and you actually got the supermassive black hole gobbling up a big chunk of matter, the two effects actually enhance one another. And so they said that's where, kind of where they're landing. They think it's not one or either or, it's actually both. But the idea that they both happen at the same time is quite interesting. Now, what they didn't discuss are the consequences of a star cluster collapsing and all erupting with these supernova explosions, or our supermassive black hole gobbling up matter and producing all this energy. If you just look at the energy output alone, it's like, good thing we weren't there when that happened, because it would have wiped us out. And then the 6 to 7 million year date is interesting, because the earliest date we have for bipedal primates, for the non-human bipedal primates, is about 6.25 million years ago. So it's like, this would have been really bad news for any bipedal hominid-type creature. So, however, some of these sprites are actually more recent. And so they were looking at, okay, what would that mean for life? Well, I've written on this before, making the point that, okay, an event like what happened 6 to 7 million years ago would be catastrophic for a species like ourselves, which you see in these other sprites that date as recently as 1 million years ago, is it would definitely be an end to our civilization, but it wouldn't be an end to the species. It would impact the health. It would have a big impact on what kind of crops you could grow. It would definitely impact the food productivity of the planet. And the cancer rate would go way up as a result of the radiation, but it wouldn't be the extinction of the species. But then it raises the issue. It seems like we happen to be living in a window, because this is something that's going to be going on all the time. We already know there's a big cloud of giant asteroids and comets orbiting about our supermassive black hole. And when the supermassive black hole gobbles up one of these things, you get a flare event. By the way, we see a flare event from our supermassive black hole almost on a daily basis. But these are cases, the energy output we see would be what you'd expect if the supermassive black hole were gobbling up a comet, say a kilometer in diameter. And that has no effect on our health or our civilization. And that happens almost on a daily basis. What we're not seeing is our supermassive black hole gobbling up bigger stuff. But we do know around the center of our supermassive black hole, there's all kinds of giant molecular clouds. And if it grabs one of those, we're in trouble. If it grabs one of the nearby orbiting stars, we're in trouble. I wrote a blog a few weeks ago making the point that there is a small cluster of stars about the size of our sun, some slightly bigger, that are orbiting around our supermassive black hole. And now astronomers are determining when they're going to get gobbled up. The good news is it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to be more than 100,000 years into the future, probably even millions of years. But the whole point is, it looks like we're in an exceptional window when our supermassive black hole is only eating little tiny bits of food. It's not eating anything big, and therefore we're not at risk. But as we look at the past history, what we see thanks to these radio maps, we realize this is quite common. Matter of fact, as I read the paper, it's amazing we're not seeing more of this. Given the size of our galaxy comes in at 1 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. Given how big our galaxy is, it's utterly a miracle that we have a supermassive black hole as small as it is, a little less than 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. And a second miracle is, with a supermassive black hole 4 million times the Sun, we should be seeing a lot more of this kind of activity, and we're not. apparently over the past 10 million years, we've been in an exceptionally quiet phase, and particularly the last million years, or the last 800,000 years, it's been exceptionally quiet. So now, where I think this has got significant philosophical significance, this is another example of an extraordinarily safe time window at the same time we human beings are on the face of the earth. And so what I'm going to do before we get into our lesson on the book of Isaiah is show you a few more of these windows. And by the way, I don't have time to show you all of them, but just enough to kind of make the case. This doesn't look like it's some kind of random accident. We have all these narrow time windows lining up at the same time, simultaneous with the existence of us human beings. Now, one that's going to be showing up in my book that's coming out in a couple of months' time, by the way, good news, they finally got a title for the book. Not a title I want, I never get the title I want, but the title of the book will be Weathering Climate Change. And the release date will be March or April. And in that book, I'm going to be showing this particular temperature graph, which basically shows you the temperature of the surface of the Earth for the past 17,000 years. And what you see there, oh, the color doesn't show up. That's supposed to be pink, and the other part's supposed to be blue. Well, I guess it does kind of show up a little bit. Okay. That pink part is basically normative temperature change for a planet. I mean, that represents what you see over the past 2.6 million years. That little blue line that you see at the top, that's something that's never happened before in the entire Ice Age cycle, where you got a period of extreme climate stability. And that little thing with a dotted line, that's basically something that they call the Younger Dryas Anomaly. And we now know that was generated by an asteroid hitting in northern Greenland 12,800 years ago. And that's what prevented the temperature from spiking up and melting the polar ice cap and bringing on another ice age. We're not in an ice age now, thanks to an asteroid hitting our planet at just the right time and just the right place, stopping the temperature from going up as high as it normally would. And what happened there, that little blue line, it's a combination of two things. You've got climate cycles working to cool a planet. And normally, they would cool the planet by about 12 degrees in the space of about 1,000 years. The reason that didn't happen is that that asteroid collision temporarily brought about a period of extreme climate stability where the temperature stabilized, that enabled the launch of human civilization, and the growth of human civilization since has generated a warming effect that's exactly canceled off the cooling effect by what's happening with the orbital cycles of our planet. And in fact, what you see there is over 9,500 years, the global mean temperature fell by 1.0 degrees centigrade. And the reason why there's all this debate about climate warming is in the last 70 years, we put it back up to 1 degree. So our planet today is now as warm as it was 8,800 years ago. It took 8,800 years to cool by 1 degree. We warmed it by 1 degree in just 1 year. Yes?
Is that negative values on the y-axis?
Okay. This is the published data, and they didn't yet have time to calculate and normalize it for the global mean temperature. So the temperature scale you see there is the air temperature that you'd expect over northern Greenland. So it's not the same as a global mean temperature. However, it's adequate to show you what was happening to the changes in the temperature. So just look at this as an example of temperature change. And if you want what the global mean temperature was, it hit a peak of 17 degrees centigrade, dropped to 16 degrees centigrade, it's now back up to 17 degrees centigrade. So, but I put this up there because the people working on this have yet to calibrate it for the global mean temperature. However, the temperature, but my whole point is, This period of extreme climate stability is identical to this period where nothing bad is happening in the core of our galaxy. And it's also a time when we got the sun's luminosity at the ideal level where we can grow the maximum crops. So this is where we are right now. And of course, what I'm writing about in the book on climate change is the remarkable idea that we got ice on planet Earth when the sun's never been brighter in the entire history of the Earth. And the other thing we notice is that we're at a period of extreme minimum of solar flare activity. This is what the flaring history of the sun looks like. And that vertical scale you see there is logarithmic. There's a factor of a million between the high point of that red curve and the low point. And we're at the low point right now. So this period of a very quiet activity in the center of our galaxy is identical to the period where we got extreme climate stability, and it's identical to the period when we got minimum solar flaring activity, and it also happens to be identical to the period when we got extreme luminosity stability in the sun. Part of the reason why our climate stability is the way it is the sun has been exceptionally stable over the past 50,000 years. And astronomers discovered this by looking at neutrinos coming out of the sun. And the interesting thing is the neutrinos come from the solar furnace to our telescopes, our neutrino telescopes, in 8 minutes. The photons that are produced at the center of our sun take 100,000 years to reach our telescopes. And so this gives us an idea what the sun was doing 100,000 years ago and what it's doing today, just by comparing the photon luminosity with the neutrino luminosity. But those studies show us that the sun entered an extremely stable luminosity phase about 50,000 years ago and will only last for about another 50,000 years. In fact, the latest says there's about a 90,000 year window when you get this exceptional solar luminosity stability. And right now, we're right in the middle of that. So now you've got four windows all lining up to be just right. Here's a fifth one. We happen to be living at a time when we got the best uranium-thorium abundance. That happened when the Earth was born. The universe hit a maximum in uranium and thorium abundance a little more than 9 billion years after the cosmic creation event. That happens to be identical to when the Earth formed. And so this is one of several reasons why planet Earth ranks as the uranium-thorium champion of the universe. To give you an idea, if we compare the amount of uranium we have on planet Earth to what we know must exist on other rocky planets the same size elsewhere in the universe, we're ahead of those other planets by a factor of 340 times. When it comes to thorium, we're 630 times more abundant in thorium than uranium. And this is something I'm actually addressing in this book on climate change, is saying we're now developing the technology to use to generate electricity from thorium reactors rather than uranium reactors. The good news is there's a lot of thorium that we can mine on planet Earth because we are on a planet that's so thorium rich. And the other good news is it's a lot safer than uranium reactors. And so that may be a new technological fix for us to generate electricity without producing any greenhouse gases. Now you say, well, that was 4.5 billion years ago. Uranium has decayed. The good news is it's now decayed to a low enough level that it doesn't really cause as much problems, unless you live in California. If you live in California, one of the things you need to know about California is that we have more uranium in our soil than the other 47 states. Alaska's got more uranium, but we're number one in terms of the 48 contiguous states. And so we're consuming a little more uranium in our diet than people, say, who live in New Jersey. So, but all it does is it shortens your lifespan by about 1 month. If you live in Denver, your lifespan gets shortened by 3 months because you're at higher elevation. course, if you're living in Bishop and you're eating all those crops that are growing there in the Owens Valley, your lifespan will be shortened by about 4 months. On the other hand, people living in Bishop are getting more exercise than we are, so they'll probably outlive us. So, but the whole point is, we're living in that window where uranium and thorium is sufficiently abundant that we can have a planet with continents and you know, continental recycling of nutrients, and also where we can use that uranium to generate power, and at the same time, it doesn't kill us. Another window is that we happen to be exactly halfway between the Perseus and Sagittarius spiral arms. We cross a spiral arm about once every billion years, but right now we're in the safest part of that crossing of spiral arms. Moreover, if you look at where we are between those spiral arms, you notice there's nothing nasty in the vicinity of us. If you look at these, this is a detailed map of our Milky Way galaxy. There's often feathers that connect in between the spiral arms. We happen to be crossing a spiral arm, and we crossed it half a billion years ago, and right now we're in a spot between spiral arms where there's nothing dangerous around. So there again, we're in a time window where things are safe for human beings. We're also in a time window when we got the maximum amount of petroleum we can take out of the ground. And so this actually looks at the abundance of a mineable petroleum in the crust of the Earth with respect to time. And so most of the petroleum we have comes from creatures that were living on planet Earth about 400 to 500, well, 350 to 540 million years ago. These would be animals that had a lot of fat and oil in them, and they got crushed by tectonic events. And there's enough time that's gone by where their fatty body fluids got converted into petroleum. And you say, well, what's now causing it to go down? Well, bacteria convert petroleum into natural gas. So that explains why we got natural gas and petroleum. But if you wait too long, the bacteria convert all the petroleum into natural gas. Bottom line is, we're living at a time where we got the maximum of petroleum to pull out of the ground. Moreover, the easy mineable stuff is stuff that exists under capstones. It takes time for those capstones to form, but if you wait too long, cracks develop in the capstones and all the petroleum leaks out. And so we're actually living at a geological moment when we got the maximum number of those capstones actually preserving easily mineable petroleum. I'm talking about stuff you don't have to frack, where you basically drill through the ground, drill through the capstone, and you pull the oil out. So for example, there's a whole bunch of those in Saudi Arabia, and they can pull out the petroleum for a cost of about 20 cents per gallon. So that's the cheap stuff. Okay, another interesting time window we live in is that we got more lakes and rivers than we've ever had before. And it's only been the last, 12, 15,000 years where our planet has been blessed with so many lakes and rivers. That's because we're now in an interglacial that has followed the most severe glacial in the entire Ice Age cycle. And because of that, our planet has more than double the number of lakes and rivers connecting them than it's ever had in the entire 4.5 billion year history of the Earth. And this actually shows you a place that's got lots of lakes. Canada actually has more than half of all the world's lakes. And if I blow this up a little bit, you can see that in the province of Quebec, it's just a network of lakes and rivers. And that's true of virtually all of Canada. To a lesser degree, it's true of Siberia, Finland, Sweden, Norway actually also has this incredible network because those are regions that were covered by thousands of feet of ice. And what's unique about the last ice age cycle is how fast the ice melted. I mean, Canada was covered between 3,000 to 4,000 feet thickness of ice, virtually the entire province, and that melted away in just 1,000 years. So an extremely rapid melt of all that ice produced this network of lakes. And if I were to go back to this one, You'll see at the bottom the Great Lakes. They weren't there before until just after the last ice age. The last ice age produced the Great Lakes. So almost all the lakes that we see on planet Earth today were generated by the last ice age. And it's because of that that instead of Canada and Siberia being deserts, they're lush forests. It's that network of lakes and rivers that transform that area, which gets 10 inches of precipitation per year, which is less precipitation than we get here in Los Angeles. It's hard to believe that a lot of people aren't aware of this, that most of Canada and Siberia is much drier than, say, what you get here in Southern California. But it's a network of lakes and rivers created by the last ice age that actually makes it a very productive area where you've got lots of animal life. And moreover, it's a place where you get a huge amount of potential hydroelectric power. I have a friend in Toronto who has a Tesla. And he says, yeah, I had to pay a few tens of thousands of dollars to buy this 5-passenger Tesla, but I can drive it 300 to 400 miles per week for the equivalent of about 55 cents a month, because electricity is so cheap there because of the abundance of hydroelectric power. So a little bit different here in Southern California, because we get most of our electricity from burning natural gas. And so I don't know if you looked at your electric bill lately, but I can tell you, you're not going to be able to drive a Tesla for 55 cents a month. So, but this is a blessing that we have here. A couple more, and then we'll get back into our lesson. Something else that's unique, and of course, I think all of us are aware, I'm from Canada, and what I notice is on the weekends in the big cities, the populations empty out of the cities, and where do they all go? They go to the lakes and rivers. So it's kind of a place they go to recover their sanity. And so I have a lot of relatives in Canada. It's like every weekend they get their canoes out and they're going down these rivers and into these lakes and really enjoying themselves. So it's a recreation benefit as well as a benefit for a civilization and a technology. And as I mentioned in the class several months ago, it's also a time, a narrow window, the last 10,000 years is unique in that it's provided us with scenery that our planet has never had in its entire history. And so all over the world, we have canyons like this that have been cut by the retreating of ice from the last ice age. You only get a canyon like this if you got thousands of feet of ice retreating in just 1,000 years or less. And the big spectacular ones where you got even more rapid ice retreat. And Yosemite Valley. It's hard to imagine, but the last ice age went all the way down into Southern California. In fact, the last ice age was such that winter sea ice actually went below San Diego, actually went down into Ensenada. That was the southern limit of sea ice during the last ice age. And so Yosemite Valley was carved out by the retreat of ice in the last ice age. And how many millions of people go there? Okay, a couple more and then we'll get back into our lesson. I think what's especially remarkable, all these narrow time windows also line up with another narrow time window where our galaxy is not producing any nearby supernova eruptions. Okay, this is a galaxy about the same size as ours, and it's a typical spiral galaxy in that it has about 3 supernova eruptions per century. And that's been the long-term average for our Milky Way galaxy. 3 supernova per century. And when a star goes supernova, it will shine with the same brightness as a couple of 100 billion stars. So it actually competes with the light of the entire galaxy. So that's where it is at maximum. This is what it looks like when it's not in a supernova phase. And this shows it going supernova. And this is a list of recent supernova that have been less than 1,000 light years from planet Earth. And this is actually the norm. This is what you'd expect if we're getting 3 supernova per century, that you're gonna get several happening within 1,000 light years of the Earth. And so this is one reason why of many reasons why humans living 40,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, weren't able to launch a global civilization. The climate was too unstable, but also the supernova were causing a problem. Supernova that are this close will not wipe out humanity. It will impact our health. The cancer rate goes up. But it especially impacts your crop productivity, because you're going to get sufficient ultraviolet radiation impacting the earth that it messes up the ozone shield, and then it begins to really diminish the amount of productivity you can get from crops. So this is another reason why humans living at that time were not able to launch and sustain global civilization. And actually, the author that came up with all of this documented 23 supernova eruptions that exploded less than 1,000 light years away from us during the past 300,000 years. These are the four that occurred where we know humans are on the face of the Earth. Okay, what's it been like during the past 9,500 years? During the past 9,500 years, these are the supernova that we've been able to see in our galaxy. And what you notice is none of them are closer than 5,000 light years away. That's sufficiently far away that it has zero impact on human health and has zero impact on plant productivity. But only in the past 9,500 years have we had this, quote, lucky circumstance where there's been no nearby supernova eruptions. And that happens to be coincident with all these other narrow time windows. And it's also a time when we haven't had any flares. Now, I mentioned before that our sun is at a minimum of flaring activity. It still flares. But what's really interesting is that we've had flares thousands of years ago. We had one in 775 AD. That would have been sufficient to basically stop our high technology civilization. But in the last 300 years, when we've had high technology civilization, no big solar flares. So what does a solar flare look like? Well, this is one that happened in 1989. Looks pretty dramatic. The only impact it had is that it temporarily knocked out the Quebec power grid. And incidentally, and you say, well, why the Quebec power grid and nobody else's power grid? Well, Quebec happened to be the closest to the North Magnetic Pole, and therefore it got the biggest pulse from this particular solar flare. It is such that the Quebec government wound up losing $13 billion because their power grid was down for a few days. They've now put in a $1 billion flare protect system, which means if they get another flare like this, or even a flare significantly bigger, the Quebec power grid will be fine. Which means, and incidentally, astronomers have determined that we get flares like this about once every 20 years. 1989 was the last time it hit, so we're a little bit overdue for getting another one. And right now, the Quebec power grid is the only one that's protected. Of course, if it happens again, the Quebec power grid will be the only one we got to worry about anyway. However, every 200 years, we get one as big as the one that happened in 1859. If that were to happen today, good probability it would shut down all the power grids all over the world. And if that would happen, it would be catastrophic to our civilization. We literally can't feed the world's population today without electricity. In fact, in the United States is at most at risk because we're extremely dependent on our power grid. So as a result of this, a lot of people are thinking maybe I need to have a backup generator just in case there's another bad flare. But it would be very difficult. I mean, you'd have to really repair the whole thing. And it would knock out our satellite communication system. I was sharing this with my sons, and they said, Dad, what's the worst that can happen? I said, well, it could shut down all of our power grids. It could take as much as 2 years to get them all back up and running. It would knock out all the communication satellites. I said, Dad, would it even knock out the GPS? I said, yeah, that would probably be the first thing to go. And they said, well, Dad, that would be the end of civilization as we know it. And it would be a problem, because a paper got published a few months ago where they've been measuring the hippocampus of young Americans, and what they're discovering is that for people under the age of 30, the hippocampus in their brain is shrinking at an alarming rate. And that's the part of your brain that basically determines directions. And because younger people are basically using their smartphones to tell them where to go everywhere, they're not using that part of their brain. And the brain is like the rest of the muscles in your body. If you don't use it, it atrophies. And so, keep using your cell phone, but once in a while get a map out and put your phone aside. Keep that hippocampus going, because you might be out in the wilderness sometime and you might need it. I was talking to my sons and they said, "Dad, when we go hiking, the phones still work. They tell us where we are and we don't need a map." So I said, "Well, if a solar flare happens, you might want to have a functioning hippocampus." So we'll see. Anyway, yes, got a question?
Yeah, we got an online question. Ruthie asks, if supernovas can increase cancer in humans, what do you think is happening in the increase of cancer of this generation?
The question from the internet there was, what about the increase in cancer that we're seeing today? And if supernova is going to increase the cancer rate, how do we explain the increasing cancer rate we have today? I think a good answer to why we're seeing an exceptionally high cancer rate, because now cancer brings about more deaths of humans than heart disease does. That's the first time in human history that's happened. Heart disease is ranked first. Now cancer ranks first. But I think part of the reason why is we've developed the technology to help people with their heart disease, and we got people living longer. If you live long enough, you will get cancer, guaranteed. So the fact that people are living longer, I think, explains why we got a higher cancer rate. And so to answer the question is, you need to look at the cancer rate per age group. I think if you were to look at the cancer rate of people aged, say, 40 to 50 today, with a cancer rate of people aged 40 to 50, say, a few decades ago, you're not going to see a dramatic increase. We see a fairly dramatic increase because people are living longer. Moreover, we're actually helping them with their other ailments. So instead of people dying from diabetes or heart disease, we have them, and by the way, we're keeping people safer too. People aren't getting killed as much in accidents as they used to. And we got better emergency service at the hospitals. It's not uncommon for people to have serious injuries in a sporting accident. They can get to a hospital in 5 minutes because helicopters get them there, and instead of them dying, they survive. They survive long enough to get cancer. So, and actually, cancer rates have been declining in terms of the types of cancer because of our technology. However, there are articles written that depending where you live, you could be at a higher risk of cancer, and that's because of certain metals that we're putting into the environment. So for example, if you're consuming more mercury than was typical 100 years ago, that will impact the cancer incidence. And other heavy metals too can do that. So in which case, you can actually get a test for how many heavy metals you have in your body. And I had that done on me 15 years ago, and it was scary how high my heavy metals were. So I actually took some chelation therapy to get the metals out and wound up putting a water purification system to keep those metals out. But of course, you might want to take some vitamin D. That helps you with the heavy metals in your body. But again, if people aren't taking appropriate care of themselves, there is evidence that tells you keeping your mind sharp and your body sharp, body physically strong, actually lowers the cancer rate. So anyway, I'm not a cancer expert, but I think you got to be careful when you say, "Well, look at this increasing cancer rate." It's actually good news. Look at the falling heart disease rate. That explains why cancer has gone up. Okay, let's jump into the lesson. By the way, I want to make this clear. This is not a complete list of narrow time windows that all simultaneously line up to make our existence possible. But I think you get the philosophical implications here, is that this is all evidence for a God that cares and loves us and wants us to launch civilization, wants us to have a large population so that billions of us can actually hear the gospel message and be redeemed.
You?
Yes.
You got another one.
Got another one?
Rick G. asks, I have been hearing about the likelihood of periodic solar micronovas. Do you think that is a concern?
Micronovas, I don't get it. The sun is not in danger of going into a nova. I think the question, and if he wants to respond, he can do so. I think he's responding to, okay, we got a supernova risk. What about the risk of novae? Novae are far more common than supernova. But a nova, to give you an idea, is about 1,000 times less powerful than a supernova. It doesn't have to be a supergiant star to go nova. It does have to be a star bigger than the sun. And the rate at which we're discovering nova is, in the neighborhood of one per year. But to be a problem for crop productivity or for human health, it's got to be within 10 light years. That's really close. And so you're actually at a greater risk from supernova than you are from nova, even though nova are much more frequent. And it's because nova are 1,000 times less powerful. So it is a risk, just like there's a risk we could get hit by an asteroid. But I think what's interesting, of all the risks we're facing here, the one that has the highest probability of causing us damage are solar flares in terms of natural phenomena. And it's also one of the easiest ones to protect ourselves against. Just do what the Quebec power grid did. Unfortunately, it costs $1 billion or more per power grid. But if the power grid gets knocked out, you're looking at a price tag of a minimum of $2 trillion. Plus, there'd be a lot of suffering that people don't have electricity. So, and particularly the food supply, because now you don't have refrigeration. Okay, let's jump into the lesson. And if you didn't get the Isaiah apologetics questions, I've only distributed 700 copies of these, but if you don't have one, take one. And any extras, give them back to me. And for those of you that weren't here and we talked about what the book of Isaiah says about how the universe will end, I've still got a few copies of that available so we can get these distributed to people who don't have them. The Bible not only talks about how the universe begins, it also talks about how the universe will end. And the book of Isaiah has the most content on that. And if you're interested, you can get the recordings of that. Go to paradoxes.org. All the past classes have been video recorded and archived. You can download them. And that's where he talked about the end of the universe. What we're now dealing with are the questions that pertain to what is the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is a prophetic book, and it's got a lot of content that deals with what's going to happen at, quote, the time of the end. In fact, we had heard a sermon today about the time of the end. The book of Isaiah has got a lot of content on it. And when I was here 2 weeks ago, we actually went through all the passages. And incidentally, they're archived at paradoxes.org. What I did is I actually typed out for you all the passages in the book of Isaiah that deal with what's going to happen in the future of humanity here on planet Earth. Not the end of the universe, but what's going to happen to the end of humanity here on Earth. Because it was 10 or 11 pages, I decided not to try to distribute them here in the class. If you want them, go to paradoxes.org. You can download them. You can print them. They're available there. But what I was encouraging all of you to do, it's a good, a quarter of the total content of the book of Isaiah. But just to sit down at one reading and go through those 10 pages. Of scripture passages that deal with the time of the end. If you do it in one sitting, you get a good idea what Isaiah is saying in toto about the time of the end. But I mentioned when I was here 2 weeks ago, we were going to focus on what Isaiah says about the modern nation of Israel. And I've actually got a handout that I just prepared, and so we'll hand this out as well. This is a collection of all the passages in the Bible. It's all on one page of all the passages in the Bible that pertain to what it says about what's referred to as the second rebirth of Israel as a nation. And as you'll see, a lot of the content is in Isaiah. And what I was basically responding to what you asked me to do. It's like, it's great we're going to look at all these Isaiah passages, but wouldn't it be good to look at the sum total of everything the Bible's got to say on it? So you got this. And again, this is available at paradoxes.org. So anybody you know who doesn't have this list, they can go to paradoxes.org and they can download and print this for themselves. Now, the significance of this, and I found this is a good way of sharing our Christian faith. How many have ever run into non-Christians who say, why pick up the Bible? It's a dusty old book that talks about things thousands of years ago. You ever heard that one? Why should I read it? It's not relevant. It doesn't talk about anything. This is where I think these passages are going to help you, because it's basically making the point, even though the Bible was written thousands of years ago, it is content that's relevant to our generation. Basically making the point, look at what it says about the second rebirth of Israel as a nation, and look what we see happening right before our eyes since 1948. And so, second rebirth in this context. We got Moses and Joshua coming into the land with the Jews out of the Exodus from Egypt, and they found the nation of Israel. King David actually founds a kingdom that stretches throughout the whole of the land of Canaan. But what happens is, as the Jews as a people begin to rebel against God, God, as you see prophesied here in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah is the most complete book in the Bible, that talks about why things are bad for the Jews just before they were taken captive to Babylon. He says, you've rebelled against God. I established you here in this land. I meant for you to be a nation that would preach righteousness to the nations. You've done just the opposite. And because of that, I'm bringing judgment upon you, and basically prophesied all the things that would happen to the Jewish nation, and how the Jewish nation would be no more. It's all prophesied here in the book of Isaiah, and long after Isaiah was dead, all that happened. Israel ceased to be a nation, and the people there were exiled to Babylon, and they were there. And the nation came back. There was a rebirth of Israel after the Persians. The Persians basically said, okay, we're going to let you rebuild the nation. So the nation thrived for a period of about 400 or 500 years, 500-year period. But then, once again, after Jesus rose bodily from the dead, we see that the Jews as a people began to walk away from obedience to the Lord. And as prophesied in the book of Daniel, but also here in Isaiah, that time came when the nation ceased to exist. As it says in the book of Hosea, chapter 6, Hosea prophesied, a time will come when you'll have no nation and no king. You'll be without a nation and a king for one day, a second day, and then you'll have a king and a nation. And basically it's a reference to the diaspora. And that's one of the questions we have here, is the worldwide dispersion of the Jews. That's the first section we're going to look at here, what the book of Isaiah and other passages in the Old Testament say about the fact that the Old Testament prophesied a time would come when the reborn nation would be no more, and the people would be dispersed all over the world. And so we have Israel as a nation. It was reborn as a nation. What we're looking at are the passages that say there will be a second rebirth of Israel as a nation. And I believe that's a reference to the modern nation of Israel in the land of Canaan to this day. But a preface to that is that With the end of the first reborn nation of Israel, there would be a worldwide dispersion of the Jews. They'd be scattered throughout the whole of the world. And then, of course, what we see here in the book of Isaiah, we read these passages 2 weeks ago, making the point there would be a grand return. That, yes, they were dispersed throughout the world, but how God's going to work things out with the Gentile nations, where the Jews scattered all over the world will come back into the land of Israel. And I think that's one thing that we've actually seen, again, especially in the last decade. I mean, when Israel was born as a nation, there were still more Jews in New York than there was in the entire nation of Israel. In fact, until just a little while ago, that was the case. With the 1973 war that broke out, there were still more Jews in New York than there were in the entire nation of Israel. Today, that's no longer a case. The Jewish population in Israel right now stands at 7.5 million. That's half of all the Jews in the world. Half of the Jews are now living in the land of Israel. There's still 3 million in New York. There's still 300,000 here in Los Angeles. But where you're really seeing the Jews empty out, they've emptied out of the Middle Eastern nations. They've emptied out of Sudan. They've emptied out of Iraq, Iran, Russia, Eastern Europe, and have poured into the land of Israel. And we actually read some passages 2 weeks ago that mentioned those nations in particular, how Jews living in Egypt and in Syria would leave those nations and come into Israel. There's virtually no Jews left in Egypt and Iraq today. There was a large Jewish population in Iraq before the outbreak of the Gulf War, but it's what happened has since. The Jews have basically left because of the extreme persecution they faced there, and now they're living in the land of Israel. But some of these passages actually say a time will come when virtually all the Jews in the world will be living in the land of Israel, which makes me think something's going to have to happen in New York and Los Angeles and Toronto, because if you look at the 7 million that live outside of Israel today, most of them live in North America. So what's going to happen here to motivate them to go to Israel? And as I've talked to Israelis, they say, well, we're aware of these passages. I actually talked to some Jews who are not Christians and said, we're aware of these passages. They're going to come back. They're going to come back because we're going to make Israel so rich, they're going to leave New York and Los Angeles because they'll make a lot more money in Israel than they will make here in the U.S. We'll see. People said maybe persecution will cause them to go. We'll see what happens. But already, half of that prophecy has been fulfilled, that they've gone back there. Okay, what I want to do, we've only got 15 minutes left. If you all got one of these, what I want you to do, because this, I think it's tough to go through Isaiah and try to pick out everything it's saying. So what I've tried to do here is bite-size it. Let's first just look at the passages that talk about what it says about scattering, God scattering Jews into all the nations of the world. And then we'll look at what it talks about the birth, the second birth of the nation. What happened? I mean, there's a prophecy in Isaiah that the nation would be born in a single day. And we talked briefly about how that actually happened back in 1948. So we're going to look at those texts. So we're basically going to go through these six headings, one at a time. And here's what I want to do it. Rather than break you up into six different groups, I want to see if we can do it all as one group. So I'm just going to have you sit there, because I notice when we break up the groups and you start talking about the passages, it takes us a little longer to get through it. These lists are not so long, but I think you can all just sit there privately, read it, and then we'll come back and see what you picked out of all those passages. Pardon me? Well, I'll have your friend there read them to you, because I understand. And last week we actually spent 35 minutes reading all the passages, and a bunch of you came up to me and said, could we please save those 35 minutes? And so that's why I put it online at paradoxes.org. But I think you can get a reader to read them for you, because I actually typed them all out. So you should be able to do you have the software that allows you to read something like that that's on your computer?
I don't
for doing that. All right. And the first list is not that long, so I think we've got enough time that I'm going to set you loose. Look at those 19 passages, and then we'll come back for some brief discussion on it. And what I'm trying to do here is equip you so when you run into a skeptic that says the Bible is not a relevant book, you can actually show them, look, it's actually speaking about historical events that are happening literally right before our eyes, or at least within the past 100 years. Okay, how about if I give you, well, how much time do you think you need? 5 minutes to get through these passages? I'll give you 10. Okay. And for those of you online, you got the passages right there in front of you. You can see them there and read them too. So we want all of you online people to be participating in this as well.